Welcome to the Creative Financing Podcast, where you'll learn how to structure terms and use various creative financing strategies to create profitable deals for short and long-term wealth. Whether you're a buy and hold investor, wholesaler, or flipper, learning creative financing will help you do more deals and unlock profits that you may not even know existed. On the Creative Financing Podcast, we break down actual deals we and our guests are doing and simplify the methods and terms used to execute these strategies. Now, let's dive in and create some terms.
Hello and welcome to the Creative Financing Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Gallegos, and I'm here with
Jeff Rappaport.
And today we are going into a new series. The new series is titled The 17 Potential Mistakes Investors Make When Using Creative Financing with Sellers. So we have a list of 17 mistakes here, and what we're going to do is I think this is going to be a two-part series. So we're gonna dive into the first seven or eight of them, and then episode, this will be episode 28 and then 29. So if you guys are tuning into 29, make sure to go back to episode 28 to catch the first part of this. Again, the 17 potential mistakes investors make when using creative financing with sellers. So this is a list, Jeff, you came up with?
Yes.
Okay, so tell us about it. What got you thinking about this?
Well, I was at a creative financing class with someone that we just interviewed, Dave Kenny, and some of the information was review for me. So I just started thinking about some of the things he was talking about, and I thought these are things that people are potential mistakes that people are making, and add that to what is being brought to us on a fairly regular basis. And I just started thinking, I have a certain way of doing things, and here's the good thing for all of you. I want to make it so that everyone loves me and this transaction. I want to go over and above what is expected. I don't want there to be problems. And if there are problems, I want to get them fixed. So I am not shady. I am not trying to deceive anyone. I am totally upfront and honest. And if there's a misunderstanding, I want to get it fixed. So this might be a little overkill because it started out as like 8 and then it went to 12 and then to 17. To be honest, I probably could have gone to 30. So we'll go through these, and perhaps before we record again, maybe I'll even have a few more. So that, you may have to change the number.
Okay.
All right. So this very first one, this is truly what someone just brought us, asking us to try to help them. They had created some financing on a property, and the seller was in prison or jail, and is in jail for like 120 days or so. And they were running out of their time frame because they needed to make a monthly payment, and the payments were high. The purchaser had just bought this property like in the last few months, so had put very little money down, had PMI, private mortgage insurance, so they weren't trying to get a big down payment, and they were only trying to make $5,000. But here's the issue that I had with it. So I asked them, how did you take this property? And the answer was subject to, which is, we've talked about that, and we're going to talk about it more in this episode. But they said to me, this is what he said: we tried to keep the terms vague. I think that's the exact opposite of what you would really should be doing. I don't want to keep the terms vague. I want to be as specific as possible. When he said vague with the seller, I said, for how long of a term? Well, it's kind of open. No, I don't want it to be open. I want it to be clear. Because if there is an issue, and I promise you there will be an issue. Here's someone that's making a decision based on going to jail. When he's out of jail, whether it's in 3 months, 4 months, 6 months, 2 years, he's not going to be happy it was vague. Okay? And if he decides to do something about it, he will probably have a case. And I don't want to be vague. So let's be clear about what I don't want to be vague about. The term. Okay? So I'm sure what this investor was trying to do is get it for as long of a term as possible, perhaps the full 30 years. Is fine if that's what you discuss. Not fine if that's not what you discuss. And it's not what you wrote in the contract. So I don't remember exactly. I didn't even see the contract exactly. So I don't know what was written. My guess is it was just kept open to whatever. Okay? You are leaving yourself open for an issue there. And an issue that's easily corrected by saying, look, we will go until we either refinance the house or we sell it and get it cashed out. Okay? Which is something that I would say. But I might say within a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
10 years, 15 years, 25 years, 30 years, whatever it may be.
Defining
but
that.
Don't be vague.
Yeah.
Okay, if you're charging principal only payments, don't be vague. It's principal only.
Yeah.
If you're charging an interest rate, it is what it is. I would not be vague.
Okay. So mistake number one, being vague.
Yes.
Okay. Don't do it.
No, don't do it.
Define specifically the terms.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So, second, and this one came up during the class, so I'm glad that I was there, is not finding out what the seller's plans are after this. So if I'm buying your property on terms, Jonathan, and I'm fine with that, but your plan is you want to go buy a new house next month, and your income isn't strong enough to qualify for a new loan
based on,
and have this old loan on your property.
Based on the debt-to-income ratio.
Yeah. Do you think that might be a problem?
Absolutely.
So do you want that problem after you've now bought the property and now you have a seller that's really angry? Because remember, anytime that you're creating financing, you're in a partnership. I mean, maybe you don't have to be friendly. You don't even have to communicate, but you're in a partnership.
Right.
And if you really needed something, wouldn't you want to be on good terms with the seller?
Yes.
So not ideal if you don't find that out. The seller in their mind thinks, I'm just going to go buy another house.
Yeah.
And then finds out they can't.
Yeah, and they
maybe
don't,
can't for months.
Yeah, and they don't know any better. Right. They don't know that that's going to be an issue. So, okay. So mistake number two, the mistake is not knowing what you're
understanding what the seller's plans are.
Yeah.
Now, is it possible that the seller says, "Now I'm not going to buy a house in the next 6 months, 12 months. You know, I can wait, whatever."
Absolutely.
But then change their mind?
Yeah.
I mean, that's possible, right?
Right.
But at least you discussed it and let them know about what the potential issues are.
Yeah, they just need to be aware of that.
And one of the things that you could do in this case is, so what if I was buying your house, contract for deed, all-inclusive, something, and you wanted to go qualify for a house? Before we did this transaction, you went down to your mortgage broker. You found out you couldn't qualify if this whole debt's against you on your debt-to-income ratio. But you did find out that if you were renting it, you would be getting 75% of that rental income. And that would allow you to qualify for the type of property. Maybe what we do is we structure it as a lease option until you buy your house. And then it's already all done. Convert it to the owner financing.
That's a great suggestion.
Yeah. So that's number two mistake, not finding out what the seller's plans are going forward.
Okay.
Okay.
Cool. All right, number three.
Number three. And then this one's something we just talked about on like one of the last episodes, but it's going to come up. It's not discussing the due on sale clause. First of all, let's talk about when not to discuss the due on sale clause. If I'm negotiating with you on buying your property on terms, I don't think I want to say, yep, Jonathan, I'll buy your house for $200,000 with 20 down and $1,000 a month. And by the way, we should discuss the due on sale clause because every loan has one and you should be aware of it.
Okay.
Okay. Let's get a yes that they're in and then discuss what, I just want to make things clear. And this would be perfect when you're dealing with the purchase agreement, when you're getting it signed. Here, let's go over this. I want to make you aware. Your loan has a due on sale clause in it. Mm-hmm. Every loan does. This is done every day, all over the country. But I want you to be aware that the lender could call the loan due.
Right.
As the buyer, or if I'm going to be wholesaling it, I could say, look, me or whomever is going to do everything that they can to resolve that issue.
Right.
And to be honest, in the many years that I've done this, I've seen it happen once and it wasn't an issue.
Right.
So there's not a lot of risk, but I want to make you aware of it.
Absolutely.
And I want to... Do you remember an episode, Jonathan? This was, I can't remember what we were talking about, but it was about isolating people's objections rather than speaking so much and creating a whole bunch more objections.
Yeah.
So, hey, there's a due on sale clause. It's possible the lender could call the loan due. Is that going to keep you up at night? And if the answer is no, I don't need to keep going.
Right.
The answer is yes. Great. Tell me what it is that you're concerned about.
Right.
And now let's deal directly with that particular issue rather than me tell you all about the due on sale clause, when it came into effect, why it's in effect, and how it can affect you. Stop trying to educate. Let's just deal with what the issues are.
Right.
Okay?
Great advice. All right.
So I want to be clear about that, but I don't want to make it such an issue.
Where you're scaring them potentially.
It is not that big of a deal. I'm telling you, it is just not. And I know all of you will be totally concerned about it, and you think it will be, but it's just not.
Right. Okay.
All right.
Number four.
Not taking into account how the taxes are going to get paid.
Okay.
So, for instance, if I'm wholesaling a contract to a new buyer, don't you think it might be a good idea that if your payment is $1,550 today, wouldn't it be a good idea to make sure that your buyer knows that that payment could change over the course of
the term.
Next year, 2, 3, 5, 10, whatever it is that you've negotiated.
Yes.
And it has nothing to do with me or the seller.
It's property taxes.
Yes. It's property taxes going up or down.
Uh-huh.
And that they're responsible for it.
Yeah.
Because if they're not, either one, they're making it to a third-party escrow.
Yeah.
And they're not sending in the right amount of money.
Right.
They're going to be in default.
Yeah.
If they're making it directly to the seller, they could be in default. If they're making it directly to the lender, they could be in default.
Yeah.
So they are responsible for that. You need to make that clear. And I would tell you to make it clear in writing that in the contract, whatever they're signing, contract for deed, all inclusive, subject to, that they understand they're not only responsible for taxes and insurance, but that it's based on what taxes do.
Right.
Okay?
Right. Okay. So number, was that five?
That was four.
Okay. So number five on, now.
Yeah. How are we going to deal with insurance, which we just talked about again? So.
Yeah.
This is my opinion. This is what I suggest. There are some other ways of doing it, but this is the way that I think is the easiest, cleanest, but it's not the cheapest. So if I'm buying your property and or I'm wholesaling your property, doesn't really matter. If I'm the buyer, you have your taxes and insurance escrowed in your payment.
Right.
What I'm going to do is I'm making a new payment to you on a new note. It may be exactly the same as your underlying, may be totally different.
Right.
If I'm making that payment, I'm making that payment plus the taxes and your insurance to begin with, your policy insurance or not. And typically what I do is I say that we'll pay their taxes, but I'm not saying their insurance. So they may have a small amount that has to be taken out of their proceeds to pay their insurance. Mm-hmm. But then I'm going to go get my own insurance policy. And I'm not going to name my seller. I'm just going to get it for me.
Right.
I'm going to ask my seller if this was a personal residence to go and change their insurance to a landlord policy. So now the seller is insured, the buyer is insured, and the bank remains insured.
Right.
Okay. Yes, there's an added expense. If you're paying for two different policies, you may or may not be, but it's worth it. Insurance, hopefully you never have to use it, but you're certainly going to want it to be there if you need it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you're not on that other policy,
you don't get paid.
You don't get paid. And if you are on that other policy or you've changed that other policy, it's then a potential red flag
for the banks.
To the lender.
Yeah, right. So mistake number five, not getting your own hazard insurance on the property.
Yes.
And just leaving the existing one in place. Of course, you want to leave that in place, but you want to get an additional insurance policy insuring yourself.
That's right. Now, if the property's free and clear, it's a little different. Because now there's no, the seller doesn't need a policy anymore. You would just get a new policy. You would name the seller as mortgagee, the bank.
Right.
And you will be the beneficiary
of the policy. Yeah, right.
Very simple.
Yeah.
One policy now rather than two.
Yeah.
Only with existing loans do you have to deal with the two.
Yeah. And that's only because banks require that the property has hazard insurance.
Yes. And they want to absolutely be named as the mortgagee.
Yeah.
And if that were to change, they would be alerted.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay,
cool. So mistake number six.
Number six. So make sure that you are clear when payments will begin, when they'll be late, and what potentially is default. So one of the things that we run into is sometimes we've been vague, and vague is open to interpretation.
Yeah.
And so when I say vague, it would be 30 days after closing. Okay, so what if we close the middle of the month? Does that mean that the payment's now due the middle of the month of the following month? In reality, it probably does. But don't we want to probably keep the mortgage payment? If there's an underlying loan, it's typically due on the 1st.
Right.
It's late after the 15th.
Right.
Do we really want our payment due to the seller and paying an underlying mortgage due on the 15th, the day that it's late?
No.
Probably not. So we want to be clear about when those payments are going to begin. So what month, what day, when they're going to be late. Now, if the mortgage payment is late on the 15th, if I'm the seller, I don't want you, the new buyer, to have up until the 15th to be late.
Uh-huh.
I want you to be late on the 3rd or the 5th.
Right.
And there's going to be a late fee.
Right.
And I would tell you that if you are collecting payments, it is important that you implement those late fees, especially at first, so then it doesn't become a common occurrence. You're right. Setting the tone.
Right.
Second, when would there be an actual default?
Yeah, what day?
So if it's a contract for deed, it's typically 30 days. Okay. If it's all-inclusive or a trust deed and note, it could be 30 days, it could be 90 days, it can be whatever. But as the seller, when you're negotiating this with the seller, you want to be clear what these things will be. Now, if you're the buyer, you may want to negotiate a little bit different terms, like, hey, I'll be late after the 8th, I'm in default after 60 days of no payments, whatever. That's up to you. But be clear. Maybe being vague could have been, 10 of these. But I'd rather be clear about it, because I can tell you, I've run into some issues with it, because there's a number of different people that have to look through this and make sure that they all see it the same way. The title company, the seller, the buyer, the third-party escrow company, everyone's got to see it the same way. And they don't always see it the same way. So
right.
Let's make it so there's not a question that they all see it the same way.
So mistake number 6 is not specifying when the payment's due, when the payment's late, and when the payment is in default.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
Cool. Number 7.
All right. And this one, I'm going to tell you, and people aren't going to listen to me. And yep, that's fine. Everyone's going to make their own decision. But I'm telling you, in just the last month, I know of at least 3 issues with this. I know of a lawsuit. I know of complaints. I know of all kinds of stuff that's going on. And it is getting people to deed you the property subject to long-term.
Okay.
When I say long-term, probably the life of the loan.
Okay.
So let me explain something. First of all, most people that deed you a property and are willing to deed it to you long-term are people that are in jeopardy of losing their house.
Right.
They're typically people that are behind on payments, that are facing a foreclosure, and they need a solution.
Right.
Okay. Or they're vastly, vastly motivated for mm-hmm. some other reason. Okay?
Right.
Those are really the only reasons that someone's going to deed you the property and say, yeah, you can have it for the next 18 years, 25 years, whatever it may be. Would you agree?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So here's what happens. People are thrilled with you when you fix the situation today.
Yeah.
You've handed them, whatever, a little bit of money. Maybe a little more than a little bit of money. You've saved them a foreclosure, which would affect their credit probably for the next 7 years.
Uh-huh.
Probably make it so they couldn't qualify for a loan for maybe up to 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
That the IRS would come after them for forgiveness of debt on the property. So having the worst bill collector after you that you could possibly have, you've saved them from all of that. They're happy. They walk away, they're thrilled with you.
Mm-hmm.
3 months, 6 months, 1 year later, short-term memory.
Right.
What have you done for me lately? Because now I want to qualify for a new house, which they wouldn't even be able to have done if it would have gone to foreclosure.
Right.
But now you're preventing them from doing something.
Right.
Okay? So now they're irritated with you. You are holding them back. They have forgotten about how you saved them. They've forgotten about whatever. Now they're thinking in their mind you've probably taken advantage of them, and that they may have made a poor decision. They may have left money on the table. They may have, whatever.
Okay? Right.
They're now rethinking the whole situation.
Right.
And you're saying, look, all I did was help. I took over your house. This is what we agreed upon.
Right.
That's all you're doing. They say that's not enough. And they take you to court. Once in court, the judge is going to look at why would anyone ever just deed over their property and not have any kind of recourse or protection.
Right.
If that judge, for whatever reason, ruled in favor of the buyer, you're screwed.
Yeah.
Okay? And there is a chance you could get screwed.
Right.
So I would tell you that be careful about the long-term deals on subject to.
Yeah.
If you're going to do long-term, which is a potential issue in itself, because making someone in that position understand that this loan's going to be in their name for, you know, a good portion of their life, perhaps, and it may prevent them from buying another house for the next 15, 20, 25 years, is an issue. Okay?
Right.
It's a potential issue.
Absolutely.
But at least if you're going to do this type of deal, do it rather, and it can be just like subject to, but as a contract for deed or an all-inclusive trust deed, where it gives the recourse back. Because now, at least if you go before a judge, there's not a lot the judge can rule against. You did it properly. You gave them the recourse to protect themselves. They signed a contract. That's what they agreed to. The judge doesn't get to decide whether it was a good deal or not.
Right.
Judge gets to decide if it's legal or not.
Right.
That's legal.
Right.
Okay.
So mistake number 7, not giving recourse to the seller.
Be careful about especially long-term subject to type deals.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
So you need to give some kind of recourse.
Yes. Okay. So why don't we do one or two more and we'll cut it off and we'll do a part 2.
Okay. Let's do 8.
Okay. So number 8 is, if there is an underlying loan absolutely insisting on that there is a third-party escrow service involved that is going to collect payments from the buyer, make payments on the underlying loan, and if there's any money or proceeds left over, mailing or sending them to the seller. Do not ever send payments to the seller directly unless the property is free and clear.
Right.
Too many times when things go wrong in life that they will have good intentions, but they need that money for something else. They think that they'll have something else is going to happen and they'll just be able to replace it. They don't make a payment on their own loan. Next thing you know, you've been paying on it for, you know, however long, and you find out you're 8 months behind.
Right. But you've been sending that check in every month to that seller.
That's right. So don't put yourself in that position. Get a third-party escrow company involved and insist on it.
Absolutely.
And even if you have to pay for it or your buyer has to pay for it, do it. I would split the cost personally, but...
Well, and they're not that expensive.
It's like $100-ish or $150 set up, and it's like $15 or $18 a month.
Yeah, so super cheap.
Yeah.
Okay, so mistake number 8, sending the check directly to your seller.
Yes.
Okay. Don't do that. Send it to an escrow company. So
that's right.
Let's stop it here, Jeff, because we're kind of right on that 30-minute marker. And then we're going to continue the 17 potential mistakes with mistake number 9 on the next episode. So thanks so much, guys, for listening. We really appreciate your ear. Pass this on if you haven't. Rate and review our show. And then give us your feedback. We would love to bring you guys content that is catered to what you're looking for specifically. So a way you can do that, we have a creative financing hotline you can call. Leave us comments or any questions you have, what you'd like to hear on the show. That's 877-409-8090. Again, 877-409-8090, or you can go to the www.thecreativefinancingpodcast.com and leave us a comment or question there as well. So, Jeff, any last words?
Well, hopefully this is helpful. I think it's things that you have to be aware of when you're structuring owner financing, but don't get overwhelmed by it.
Yeah. Well, these are pretty simple. So just think of this as a checklist, guys, and just follow this checklist when you're putting a deal together. That's it, really. Yep. Cool. Till next time, create some terms.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Financing Podcast. We need your feedback to continue to bring you the best strategies in creative financing. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We greatly appreciate your ear, and please pass this on. Until next time, create some terms. This show offers general information on creative financing strategies and real estate investments. Nothing contained herein should be considered personal, legal, or financial advice. Every state has individual laws governing the use and type of documents used to execute strategies discussed herein. You should consult with a local licensed real estate broker and attorney before relying on any information contained herein. Information is not guaranteed, and opinions of the guests are their own. Profits are not guaranteed, and there's always inherent risk in real estate investing.